Case number 15-5304 et al. Carpenters Industrial Council et al., Lewis County, a municipal corporation of the state of Washington et al., appellants, versus Sally Jewell et al. Mr. Rutsett for the appellants, Ms. Drummond for the appellant, Lewis County et al., and Mr. Gray for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mark Rutsick, representing the Carpenters Industrial Council. Plaintiffs, which include a labor union of lumber workers, a county in California, lumber producers, and forest land owners. In the Pacific Coast states, much of the forest land is distributed in a checkerboard of one-mile sections, fault sections, which alternate between federal ownership and private ownership. And typically, the distribution is you have a section of federal land that is surrounded on all four sides by private land, and it's next to a section of private land that is surrounded on all four sides by federal land. Usually, the Forest Service or the Interior Department manages the federal land. On pages 91 and 92 of the Joint Appendix, we describe the checkerboard relationship between one of our plaintiffs, Seneca Jones Timber Company, and the adjoining federal land.
Let me ask you, Mr. Rutsick, how are the declarations in support of standing in this case different from those brought in Swanson Group that were found lacking?
Well, they are completely different because the declarations, the distinguished between the three original declarations,
right,
and the nine, what we call the new declarations.
Let's talk about the original declarations, because obviously there's an issue about whether we can look at the nine, but let's just focus on the three original declarations. How were they different from those that were found lacking in Swanson Group?
I would say that they're not different in any significant way.
So in that case, if we were allow the...
They're not different? They are different.
Well, they're different on the issue presented in the Swanson case, which was economic injury, and the fault was we didn't rule out every other possible cause of injury other than reduction in timber sales. Mm-hmm. There's also nothing here in this case about ruling out the other causes of timber sales.
But on the number of people who lost jobs and the shutdown of the plant, this had specifics that Swanson did not.
That is correct. From the Carpenters Industrial Council representative, it has the number of lost jobs.
Which was the key fact that Swanson Court pointed to that was missing from the Swanson Declaration.
So in that sense, of course, there is a difference. I was kind of focusing
on... I know you're focusing on the other,
yeah,
the other
so
issue.
I'll take back my concession,
yeah, okay,
to that extent, if it was a concession. The new declarations, and I'll talk about that in a minute, address what the Swanson court said was missing. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, we learn from our mistakes and we try to correct our mistakes. I was the counsel on the Swanson case, so obviously after the decision we try to provide the information that the appellate court says we have to have. So that information is in the record. It's particular pages 112 and 113 of the record. the declaration from the representative of the Rough and Ready Lumber Company.
We have lots of authority that suggests that that's too late, right? You're supposed to bring that at an earlier stage of the proceedings, and that's what the district court ruled on the newer declaration.
Question of showing good cause for filing the declarations is really the key issue, because what happened was the government filed their response to the show cause order after we did, and in that they said you didn't show good cause. Now, before that moment, we didn't have any reason to believe we had to show good cause, because we recounted in probably painful detail all the cases going back to the 18th century where parties have submitted declarations in response to show cause orders without ever in a single case having to show good cause.
So what if, I was a little bit confused by this, because whatever might traditionally attend in order to show cause, if the district court just says after the fact, yeah, I issued something called an order to show cause, I've now done the common law, the rich common law history that you all had done, and I realized that I made an error in terminology. What I wanted was briefing. That's what I wanted. Then would we be here? Because it just seems like it's within the district court's discretion at this stage of the case to say, I've already got factual information on standing. You already had a chance to give me affidavits. Yes, we have a new decision, and I want briefing on whether that new decision affects the existing lay of the land. I issued a thing called an order to show cause. I didn't realize that it had all these trappings associated with it. I'm just going to look at briefs.
No, we would still be here, because in any event, we have the right to request filing of new declarations upon a showing of good cause. And the problem in the district court was that when the government said we didn't have good cause, we tried to show the good cause. We filed a brief that showed the good cause,
but
and the district court
refused.
Your
argument for good cause was twofold. One is, we got an order to show cause, and therefore there's good cause. And I'm just taking that one out, because I'm just saying the district court just says, yeah, I filed it as an order to show cause. That was just wrong. Let's just say by hypothesis, even giving you the benefit of the doubt on what an order to show cause necessarily entails.
Yeah.
You know, my mistake, I phrased it incorrectly. I wanted briefing. Then you had a second argument as to why good cause had to be found, which is that Swanson came down.
Yes.
Now, so then it all turns on that. Because if it's not true that a district court would not necessarily abuse its discretion by declining the opportunity to file additional factual material in response to an intervening decision, then at that point, we're back to having made a mistake in terminology. Right? So you have to win on the notion that Swanson necessarily gave you good cause, and any court would abuse its discretion to decline the opportunity to file additional factual material in response to an intervening decision.
Sort of back to that, but with the caveat that the district court actually never addressed the question of good cause. There is a conclusory statement that says you didn't show good cause, but there's no explanation of why we didn't show good cause, so you really can't discern the district court's logic.
So what is the good cause here?
Good cause
presented by Swanson. As I read Swanson, is that your affidavits were inadequate, right, in Swanson. And the suggestion is they're inadequate in this case at summary judgment. So is that good cause to take another bite at the apple?
Well, when judges apply the good cause standard, the principal thing they look at, it's most commonly is there any prejudice to the defendant of filing something new for the record? The government has never claimed there was any prejudice to them from the new declarations. I mean, it's a kind of a gotcha game here. I'm sure you can perceive that we have the information, we submitted it, and the government is saying, well, it's too late. You didn't have
I'm not quite sure. Maybe I'm missing something. I'm not quite sure I'm perceiving the gotcha nature of it. Because if the district court never had to give you an opportunity to file additional factual material in the first place, the fact that the district court issues something that is construed to give you that opportunity doesn't necessarily create an irrevocable entitlement to a windfall.
No, I'm accepting the premise of your question.
Okay.
I'm talking about Swanson.
Swanson is the gotcha because Swanson, your theory, I think, is Swanson's the gotcha because Swanson changed the law from mountain states.
Yeah, and I mean in
which
Swanson.
Which would equally be true in Swanson itself. So it was unfair in Swanson itself, but apparently that was enough.
Well, those are my private conversations that I'm not going to have here, obviously. But in this case, we had an opportunity within the litigation to explain why we had standing in a way that we apparently failed to in the Swanson case. So, I mean, that why isn't that good cause? That's good cause. There's no prejudice.
And this is a helpful question, but even the government obviously thought you had standing.
Well, the government thought we had standing because they didn't challenge standing.
Exactly, because they read Mountain States to show, even though they challenged the declarations in Swanson based on Mountain States, they did not challenge the declarations in this case based on Mountain States because the declaration in this case is so much more substantial. The original ones. Mm-hmm. Are so much more substantial. Presumably, I'm going to ask them about
that. Yeah, you'd have to ask them why they didn't, but certainly it's true that they didn't. And when we challenged the 2008 critical habitat in this court, and the government did not challenge our standing in that case. So they have a long history of not challenging standing on critical habitat challenges until the Swanson case came along. So obviously, they thought there's something about the Swanson case that changes things, all right? Fine. So they changed their position, and I mean, this is a little bit of a gotcha, maybe not a little bit, but it's a gotcha too, because of course I know a party can raise jurisdiction at any time, but if you're silent, you don't challenge it, you wait till the briefing is over and then say, oh, by the way, you don't have jurisdiction, well, then you lose the chance to respond in the summary judgment briefing. And to supplement the record at a time when you have the record.
If this case was already up on appeal at the time that Swanson came down, would we have been obligated to remand to give you a chance to supplement the factual record because Swanson comes along and supposedly a brand new law that affects the case?
I'm not going to say you'd be obligated, but I think we would have the right to ask you to do that.
Of course, you definitely would have the right to ask, yeah. And the question would be, would we have the right to say no? And it sounds like any time a decision comes along, that a party would like to have an opportunity to address through new factual material, that necessarily gives rise to good cause.
Necessarily gives rise to good cause, but in this case, the government thought that the Swanson case changed the landscape and they reversed themselves on our standing. So why isn't it fair that we have an opportunity to respond to the government's new position by presenting new information to answer their belated but legal challenge to jurisdiction.
I think there's no doubt that you should have an opportunity to address the government's legal arguments. I think the question is whether you necessarily have an entitlement to submit additional factual material when summary judgment had already been handed down. That's all I was trying to get.
Well, let me talk about the wildfire stand. Well, I'm out of time, so. Well, I have a couple.
Go ahead.
Talk about the wildfire standing issue because that is presented in the original three declarations in the declaration from Siskiyou County. And the first thing is that the district court, not clear what standard the district court applied, but the proper standard for standing for adjacent landowners is the so-called geographical nexus standard, which only requires that the neighbor who is suing show that there is a demonstrable risk of injury or a demonstrable increase in the risk of injury. In this instance, the demonstration of the risk of injury is not only in the record from the fires that occurred and damaged property of two of the companies involved in the case, but we have Congress having enacted a statute, the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, in 2003. We actually, this year, have President Obama signing an executive order recognizing the destructive force of wildfire on adjacent property. We have the Ninth Circuit back in 1994 recognizing demonstrable risk of wildfire in exactly this situation is indistinguishable. So there is a demonstrable risk, for sure, of wildfire spreading to adjacent property. And taking 3 million acres...
Mr. President, unless my colleagues have further questions, okay. We'll stop you there. We'll give you some time back on rebuttal. Hear from the governor. Oh, I'm sorry, hear from the intervener. Excuse me.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Susan Drummond. I represent the counties of Skamania, Lewis, and Klickitat in Washington State. The counties join Carpenters in requesting that this court find that both have standing. Roughly one-third of Washington's nearly 3 million acres of spotted owl critical habitat is located within the counties, with nearly 20% of Lewis County designated and nearly half of Skamania County designated. The counties challenged the rule because the rule did not address the true cause of spotted owl decline. Forests are not the limiting factor, yet the rule focuses on that rather than the primary culprit, the barred owl. U.S. Fish and Wildlife used computer models to manipulate barred owl presence to create habitat which exists in cyberspace, but it doesn't exist on the ground. As a result, over 800,000 acres of spotted owl habitat was designated within the three counties based upon a fiction.
And the harm to you is?
There are a wide range of injuries that are affecting the counties. They include economic interests. They include their regulatory interests. The counties, for example.
Can you spell out the economic interests?
There's a long background with regard to the spotted owl in terms of nearly three decades of trying to manage that species. The rule adds on to that. So the counties are particularly vulnerable to begin with, but the rule as a practical matter is a threat to the well-being, the economic well-being, to the county's tax base, to their employment base, and it adds on to the harms that they're already suffering economically, because particularly with regard to Skamania County, where you have over nearly half the land base, or over 500,000 acres designated within the county, it has an enormous impact on the logging that occurs within the counties, and also there were arguments earlier from Mr. Rutzik on the wildfire issue. And the counties have a very strong environmental interest in protecting their forest lands as well as the spotted owl. They're required under the State's Growth Management Act to adopt regulations to protect both their forests and the spotted owl. They have both of those in place. And so the counties have environmental interests as well as economic in their forests and in managing those forests. And with the commingling of the lands and the county's adjacent lands that are adjacent to those forests are particular issues for both the counties and private landowners, and our declarations address the amount of acreage that is adjacent to those forest lands, and that presents a real issue for the counties, and they're particularly vulnerable. There are a number of facts addressed in the declarations regarding wildfire risk within southwest Washington. Also, with regard to the spotted owl, the counties in adopting their regulations they're required to use best available science as well, so the rule is an impediment to recovering both the spotted owl and recovering the forest. I see that I've got 10 seconds left.
No, you don't.
So, I would briefly wanted to point the court to funds.
No, your time actually is up.
Oh, it is. I'm fine.
Apologies.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Gray. I'm here on behalf of the Fish and Wildlife Service. The problem with the original declarations and the new declarations is that they're all conclusory in nature when they come to alleging.
Why did you challenge them?
The trial attorneys have to make judgments in each case about what they're going to challenge, what they're not, based on their judgment as to what's likely to be the most successful here. And
they made the judgment that this would not be successful.
They made the judgment that there were better grounds on which to defend the suit at that time.
Really? They threw away a jurisdictional...
The courts, it was still under an obligation to consider its own jurisdiction.
I understand that, they threw away their own opportunity to advance a ground that would have...
I wouldn't say that they threw it away. They could raise it later, as they did. And, a case like... Lake Swanson Group can have a clarifying effect on how you see the facts in your case, even if it doesn't change the law.
Let's talk about Mountain States, because Mountain States, the declaration, is bare bones. It's right here. It's bare bones. There's one paragraph that's really relevant, and it's got virtually nothing in it. The only really distinction that Swanson seizes on is that it specifies that there was going to be a temporary closing of the mall and a permanent layoff of the 25 workers. And Swanson seizes on that as the distinction. Now, I think what happened is, based on Mountain States, you all did challenge in the district court the Swanson declarations.
Yes.
Because it didn't have that kind of detail. You did not challenge the declarations in this case, the Parton declaration in particular, because the Parton declaration, if you stack it up next to this Mountain States declaration, it's not even close. It's got all sorts of detail about specific harms to, and it does specify, and this is the key in distinguishing Swanson, it does specify particular layoffs at Rough and Ready, that Rough and Ready was going to have to close, and it specifies the number of employees affected, right, in paragraph 10. So that's why, I mean, you can tell me if this is wrong. That's why your attorneys, who I think are very good, said we don't have a case to raise a standing challenge under Mountain States.
I'm not sure. I don't want to speculate about exactly what those attorneys thought at the time they did it. But
okay,
let me tell you why this is different
from
Mountain States and why these declarations are not good enough, even under Mountain States. Mountain States, of course, involved a particular project.
Right.
There was a sale where the forest had to choose between alternatives. One alternative involved cutting more timber. One alternative involved cutting less timber. And they sued and they said, we need the alternative with more timber. Here, the problem with these declarations is that they are conclusory when they allege that the critical habitat designation will inevitably result in fewer timber sales.
And where did the Mountain States declaration say something like that?
Well, they were dealing with a particular project. They said, what the court said in Mountain States is, if you go with the alternative that was selected, there are fewer trees cut. If you go with the alternative that they are suing to enforce, there are more trees cut. So it was because it was a specific project, the declarations there were good enough. Here, it's true that they have information about the number of employees, but the impacts that they really all relate to, they say it started in 1990 when the owl was listed as threatened, and there's been a reduction over time, and then only at the very end do they say the critical habitat designation will lead to further reduction. And that's not good enough, because in the final rule, the critical habitat rule, it says right up front, this rule does not take any action or prescribe any policy or plan or program for timber, for active timber management, active forest management. It says we designate it's all federal land. There's no private land. There's no state land.
Will the critical habitat designation eliminate any sources of supply for these timber manufacturers?
They have not alleged that it will.
Can you just answer my question?
No, I do not believe that it will. Because
really?
What the critical habitat designation does, I mean, it says it right in the, if you look at the final rule, it says this. They did what's called the final economic analysis, and it's described in the rule.
Well,
it's also.
Is your answer no, or is it that it's not necessary? In other words, do you know for sure that it never will, or is
well,
your response
I don't,
that
it does,
is, there, is your response more that we don't know yet, and that's the problem?
Right. There may be. I mean, I guess it is conceivable that there would be a particular project where consultation would result in the dropping of units or whatever, but the rule itself doesn't do that.
Conceivable, that's a bit of an understatement, isn't it? I mean, not to try a witticism here, aren't we missing the forest for the trees here? Is there any serious doubt that this listing has had a significant economic impact? And is there any reason to think it won't have a further impact?
The listing of the species, I think there probably is not much doubt that that's had an impact. but the critical habitat designation, which is all this issue here, they did a final economic analysis that's in the record.
That does indicate some effect.
What it says is that we've modeled three scenarios. One is no effect. Everything will stay just as it is. One is there may be some detrimental effect. And one is the resource agencies may actually increase, because one of the things you want to do when you're managing habitat is reduce the risk of fire. And so they may actually increase the number of thinning projects to reduce. And it says we can't say for certain which one of those is true, because that relies on the discretion of the land management agencies here. And, of course, that's the critical component here.
What does critical habitat designation do?
It requires...
As distinct from listing the species. Just explain it to me what it does.
Yeah, if there were an area that is designated critical habitat and is unoccupied by the species, for example, which is where you would see the most impact from the designation itself, and there was a project to go forward, then they would have to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service on whether that project would destroy or adversely modify the critical habitat. And what the courts have said, I mean, here we're talking about 9.5 million
acres. What does that mean? Can the Fish and Wildlife Service put a stop on a project?
I don't think the Fish and Wildlife Service can put a stop on a project necessarily. They will do a biological opinion that would say, we think this is going to result in adverse modification of the habitat, but it's up to the land management agencies to comply with the Endangered Species Act. And so the way this would work is, in an area like this, you're unlikely to see much in the way of adverse modification, because the area of critical habitat is so large, and because you need to have active forest management in order to reduce the risk of wildfire and disease to keep the habitat healthy for the owl.
Your distinction of mountain states is based on the proposition that in that situation there was a specific project at hand. So is your view that when a critical habitat designation is made, it's not to the exclusion of the possibility of standing when a particular project comes up and BLM takes a decision based on what sounds like a recommendation from a service about the
impact
on the spotted owl?
So it's just too early now? I'm sorry.
That's exactly right.
They're conceding their standing when they challenge a specific project.
They still have to meet all the elements of the standing doctrine, and they're going to have
promising something that you're going to resist in the next case. I'm pretty confident.
They'll have to. I mean, I do think that it would be that they would be able to plead a case in which they would have standing, where, you know, if you have a company that, say, is going to bid on a sale, the sale is in critical habitat, they consult with the agency, and the agency says, we're going to drop, they ultimately say, we're going to drop these four units and reduce the total amount of timber because, you know, this would be better for the species, and the land management agency goes with that, and they can say, because of that, we're going to make less money and have to, our employees will be hurt and everything. But I think they're going to have to make all of those links.
I mean, they're saying that kind of writ large are a number of places that are the supply. So I'm going to start with Mountain State says, government acts constricting a firm's supply of its main raw material clearly inflict the constitutionally necessary injury. Here we have with five different companies, them all alleging these areas within the designation are the places where we get the raw material, and it's just, I mean, our standing law. So I'm sympathetic to you in one key respect. Our standing law is a mess, and I've said that before. This is common sense, which is if you're a company and you're getting your raw material from a place, and the government says you can no longer get the raw material from that place, that's got to be an injury. Now it may be a lawful decision.
I'm with you all the way on that, except for the proposition that here the government said you can no longer get your timber from that place. That's what's missing. That's what's missing in this case is they just say it's inevitable. You designate a critical habitat, we're going to get less. But the economic analysis said that wasn't true.
This is where common sense, as you're probably aware, I've said we shouldn't check our common sense in standing cases. You look at the hollowed out communities all over the Northwest. the rural communities that are described in the declaration, because people have lost their jobs because of these designated, and that may be all entirely lawful and proper, but the idea that there, people haven't been injured?
I think common sense would have said that the plaintiffs in the Clapper case in the Supreme Court were going to talk to some of their clients and have the communications intercepted. But the standard, court said it's too speculative. It doesn't matter that it's hard to prove.
But it's not certainly impending. You quote that, and there's the key footnote in Clapper, which talks about substantial likelihood. So it's a probabilistic, and this is and key. It's not a certainty. It's a probabilistic evaluation. And then, you know, how do we do this is another question. But anyway, the probabilistic evaluation, that's where you're. When you take away someone's supply and you see all the hollowed out communities in the rural areas of these Northwest states.
And I might agree with you at the motion to dismiss stage in this case, because the general allegation is presumed to include the specific facts. But when you get to summary judgment, you have to plead it. The case can't be more clear at this point. If you're a plaintiff in 2016,
it's really
you have
not
to
a
know.
Pleading thing, though, that I think you're describing. What you're describing is that there's no way to plead it.
No, I'm not saying there's no. I'm saying they need to have a particular project that has a particular effect, and the only ones they identify here post-date the complaint.
Can I ask this question, which is that?
But they don't post-date the amended complaint.
There is one
don't
of
we look
the
at
three,
the amended,
that, and it's an open question, I think.
You don't look at the amended complaint?
This court has said, you know, the phrase this court has used is that you look at when the complaint was first filed. The Supreme Court and this court haven't resolved yet. I think it would have been much cleaner.
Can you explain a rationale by which we would not look at the amended complaint for purposes of what you're describing?
If the idea is to keep plaintiffs from bringing speculative claims before their right, then you would want to look. Otherwise, you bring a suit, you file your complaint, and then you say, "Well, we'll figure out our standing later, and we'll just amend." That's the best rationale. It also, I think, you know, had they sought to supplement
like
here with other facts,
whether you can amend a complaint. Once you've amended the complaint, it seems difficult to say that. That's not the relevant instrument. Okay, can I just ask you this question, which is that, whatever we might think about the way standing should be done in the abstract, we have to deal with Swanson. And on Swanson...
And Mountain States.
And Mountain States, definitely. And Swanson does deal with Mountain States, of course, so we're dealing with the corpus of that. Yeah, absolutely. So Swanson has, and on the part where it talks about Mountain States is on the injury prong. Swanson also talks about causation and redressability. Separately, and the focus of your argument so far has been, I think, on injury. And as to causation and addressability, which were both found lacking in Swanson for better or for worse, one thing that seems different about this case is that here, at least in Swanson, the entity that was being hailed into court was the entity that actually was restricting the timber sales because it was the BLM.
Right.
Here you're one step removed from that. Now, I think there's a lot of common sense to the proposition that this is having a practical effect, and you know, we can discern that. I'm just trying to marry it with Swanson in a situation which, in circumstances of that case, the court found no causation or redressability, even though, apart from injury, even though we were talking about
there is a significant problem here with relying on the actions of the third parties, and I think, of course, if you remove the critical habitat designation, then, you know, there's no guarantee at that point most of their declarations say we want an increase from the current level, and there's no guarantee that removing the critical habitat designation would lead the BLM or Forest Service to increase the baseline timber
the
production over what
that,
they've already
you
done.
You just said no guarantee, and I understand why you said it, but that's not the standard. The standard's a probabilistic standard.
But they have to show it's a probabilistic standard, but they have to show some evidence that there's a third party, and the cases are replete with the saying that, you know, if you're relying on the actions of a third party, that especially an agency that has wide discretion, then it's not, you know, that breaks that chain.
I have two things about causation. On causation, Swanson linked back to the injury. Without information about Rough and Ready's past injury, Felipe's declaration does not show that the economic losses fairly can be traced. So it links back to the failure, and this is how it gets distinguishes Mountain States, the failure to talk about specific numbers, because Mountain States, again, with this declaration, had specific numbers, and here we have specific numbers with Rough and Ready.
Again, but the specific numbers go to injuries they suffered not a result of the critical habitat designation. And I think that's the key point here, is that the specific numbers they provide all go to injuries they've suffered for some other reason, and they say, we think the critical habitat designation is going to contribute further to it. But there's no showing as to why that is so, why the final economic analysis said it could be any one of three results. It may turn out that the land management agency's increase.
Well, can I ask you about that? Because I'm looking at page 72028, and there's a paragraph that says, we find that incremental economic impacts to USFS timber harvest are relatively more likely in unoccupied matrix lands, or approximately 1.1 million acres of 2.6 million total.
Yeah, if you continue, it says incremental impacts are more likely, and if you continue reading the full section, what it says is there's three possible outcomes. One is no impact, because they'll say the same. One is that there will be some negative impacts, and one is that there will be positive impacts because the land management agencies will increase timber. And then it says these agencies have discretion, and we can't say which one of those is more likely. They're here saying, well, it's going to be decrease. But they don't prove it. They don't have any specific facts to prove
says,
it.
Maybe I'm misreading the sentence. We estimate that incremental, this is a different sentence, we estimate that incremental economic impacts due to the critical habitat designation would be relatively more likely to occur in unoccupied areas.
Yeah, but the difference is it's saying incremental impacts, but it doesn't say whether those impacts are positive or negative in that sentence. And if you read the full thing, it says there's a range of outcomes. We think there'll be some impacts, but we don't know whether they'll be positive or negative. They've just asserted it'll be negative, but the final economic analysis says
how could it be positive
for these
companies?
If the land, so for example, if the Forest Service were to conclude that in order to protect the critical habitat, it's necessary for the critical habitat to go in and do more thinning where they haven't done it before, that would increase the number of sales and make more timber available, and the economic analysis goes through that and says this is one possible outcome, and it actually quantifies it, I think it was on the range of $2 million or something potential positive outcome, and then it says we don't know because it depends on the discretion of the land management agencies. We don't know if that's going to happen or if it's going to be a negative impact, and They have to show something that shows there is an actual negative impact from this in that situation. I think it'd be a much different case if the final economic analysis had said this is definitely going to be a detriment, a negative impact, but we don't care because the critical habitat's important.
One of the things I'm trying to do is, as you can tell, square Mountain States and Swanson, try to figure out where the sweet spot is there. And I know you're familiar with that. In Mountain States, the court said the plaintiffs may not have any particular right to federal timber contracts, but no such right is required any more than a right to view crocodiles for the plaintiffs in Lujan.
We have not challenged the notion I think it even goes even further. The courts have said that the right to bid on a benefit can be an injury, and I don't think that's the problem.
Okay.
The problem is that they've not shown any specific evidence or any particular project where they've been injured.
How about
in this case?
And here's another sentence, the last one I'll read from Mountain States just to get your reaction, because that's helpful. Thank you. Given the company's historic dependence on the Upper Yak for its supply, together with the disruptive effect of the past shutdown, logging cutbacks in the Upper Yak clearly inflict injury on the firm's economic well-being, which an order reducing the cutbacks would redress.
And again, the key there is logging cutbacks. And what's missing from these declarations is any specific evidence that there will be a reduction in logging. That's what's missing. That's the problem.
And you, You really think there's doubt about that?
The final economic analysis, which is in the record and conducted, you know, a robust economic analysis conducted for exactly this purpose, says there's doubt. So, yeah, I'm comfortable saying that there's some doubt.
People are just seeing ghosts.
And if there's not, and if there's not doubt, if there's not doubt and there's a particular project, then they can bring a suit at that time and plead it in the way that I've talked about.
So it's more a ripeness thing. I realize standing and ripeness overlap, but it's not.
It's that the allegations here aren't quite concrete enough yet. There's not the impending imminent injury.
Let me just explore this because I'm sure we'll be back here in 2 years. But if they have a specific place that they say is no longer available, and we would have gotten timber from there, gotten raw materials from there. Is that good enough?
I think that's probably, if they say we're a company that operates in this place has been removed completely, and it was removed completely because of the critical habitat designation, and that's going to cause us economic injury. I think that's probably good enough. But they haven't done it.
It's not just a pleading problem now. You're saying there's actually no way under the facts that we have it now that they could plead.
Right.
In such a way to have standing, because no decisions have been made that are going to harm them economically?
I think under these facts, that's right. And again, I think it would be a different case if the economic analysis did say, you know, or you had some actual specific facts that said this will happen. So, for example,
the declaration that you
referred to earlier, the Sanders Declaration, which talks about a couple of specific projects. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's getting close. Yeah, right. Of course, those post-date, except for the one on the amended complaint. But what's...
Well, the ones all they need.
Well, if in fact you do look at the amended complaint, which, you know, hasn't been settled, but even as to that one, I'm not sure that the allegations as to that particular project are as concrete as some of the others in there. But, if they had come in and said, you know, these are projects where we're losing timber... and we expect that will continue with other projects. That's much closer. But the other problem, of course, with Sanders is you have the Rule 6 issue where that was not properly in front of the court.
If it's a pleading thing, if it's just a pleading thing, I think I disagree with you because the pleadings, the affidavits are replete with what you just said.
I don't think that's how.
But your point is that they're pleading
the affidavits.
I think your point is that
Sanders affidavit is the best one that they have, but of course that was excluded by the district court because it wasn't timely filed.
Can I ask?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Question or two about that. So on the good cause, why isn't it good cause that a new decision came down from this court that changed the law?
Well, I think we would disagree that it changed the law. As I said, the beginning of this, I think it clarified how you look at the facts of these things.
The reason I challenge you on that and going back to is obviously it changed the law from your guys' perspective.
Well, I think you may be attributing.
You guys are not hesitant to impose standing objections, as you're well aware, and you didn't.
It's
in
the
this
first
case.
Item on the checklist, isn't
yes.
it? For answering
based
complaint.
On the last case, you don't always interpose sovereign immunity objections.
Not your bailiwick.
Things sometimes get missed or not fully appreciated at the time.
And it's the same, but. I understand you're in a tough position here, but let me just play out my position and you can shake your head no.
Okay.
It's a tough position. You say you're making decisions. It's the same basic kind of case about the same basic area for the same basic issue with at least one, I checked, of the same lawyers for you guys involved. And yet in one case you raise the standing pretty aggressively, Swanson, I think because it lacked the detail that even Mountain States Bears it was had. In the other case, you've got the pardon declaration.
The sequence of events may be also important here in understanding how you can come to that judgment where, of course, they had lost the standing argument in the district court in Swanson and were front of the same judge.
Right, Judge Lynn.
I don't know if you're making a judgment on how best to use your limited space in responding to a summary judgment motion that you know, that's necessarily a place you want to go, knowing that you can, if Swanson is successful in appeal, you'll be able to raise it later.
But I think they, I mean, the timing, the chronology as I look at it, you all challenge standing in Swanson. Their complaint is filed later in this case, and they probably learn, just speculating, from your objections to the complaint in Swanson, so they beef up the declarations here with the Parton Declaration and the other ones, which are much more robust. Your lawyers look at it and say, well, that, you know, how can
we
object to
that? Well, we didn't win Swanson in the district court, and, you know, so...
So maybe that's,
so,
okay.
You know, and,
that's
and,
a good answer.
You know, so now maybe we're not going to, you know, go up against this same judge with the same argument at this point.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair point, but what about the good cause then? Assume it's a change as opposed to a clarification.
Okay.
Is a change? And
I think if what had happened here was they had come in and they had filed a motion and said we want an extension of time on our declarations because there's been a change and we want an opportunity to address it. And if the district court had said, okay, I see that there's been a change and I'm going to allow you to address it, I do not think the United States would be here on an affirmative appeal arguing that was an abuse of discretion. But what actually happened was exactly what happened in National Wildlife Federation. They just simply attached the new declarations to what they filed without filing a motion and without seeking leave of the court. And I think it was within the court's discretion under National Wildlife Federation at that point to say, no, it's too late.
Do you think it was crazy not to read the show cause order as allowing them to submit new affidavits?
I'm not going to say it's crazy, but I think it was probably wrong. If, for example, an appellant in this court failed to file a brief and the court issued a show cause order why the case shouldn't be dismissed for lack of prosecution, you wouldn't then just come in and file your brief. You'd file a motion for leave to file the brief out of time. And I think this is not, you know, what the district court did was not the typical show cause process. It was, the sequence of events was they had their opportunity to prove it. You know, they had the opportunity to provide declarations.
Well, we do issue show cause orders, and I'm just going on memory here for things like standing or jurisdictional issues, and we'll also get, I think, back argumentation plus affidavits. But that's, kind of standard practice.
In this court, you know, of course, you're not, Rule 6 is not.
Yeah, no,
it's
different.
You know, Rule 56 says you file affidavits in support of a motion at the time the motion is filed, and Rule 6 says if you don't do that, you have to seek leave of the court and show your good cause. And where they don't seek leave, if nothing else, National Wildlife Federation says the district court's not obligated at that point to accept it. And this court even has a case, which I'm blanking on the name of right now, where it said if there's no motion filed, there's no discretion to exercise. And in that case, the court had let it in. Let the additional documents in, and this court said, no, that's an abuse of discretion.
And here he does the show cause order. They come in with the briefing of the submissions, including the new affidavits. You all object, and then they submit a reply that says, here's why we have good cause. Yeah, and the district court says, I'm not going to consider that.
Yeah, again, because of the sequence, it's just too late.
I mean,
the sequence of events.
You know, I have some mild desire not to make the litigation process a hall of mirrors.
I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you. Unless there's further.
Thank you. Mr. Isaac, we'll give you back a couple minutes.
Thank you very much. I have a few points to make. The independent case, the Supreme Court said that Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinions are determinative on the action agency. So when the Fish and Wildlife Service says, you shouldn't do X, they really can't do X.
Would you address the point about the economic analysis, which suggests that we don't know that there will be economic harm?
I'm going to say two things. First, we don't need an admission from the government to establish our stand. Sure, it would be great if they said, yes, there's going to be economic injury. They didn't say that. We don't need that. We pointed to 9 quotes from the record which contain the information that says that the most cutting one, that's a bad pun, the most relevant one is they said we will not allow traditional timber cutting or timber harvest in the critical habitat. Well, look, they don't mean they're going to allow more cutting. they mean they're going to allow less cutting. And they go through over and over again, you should stop doing what you were doing and use the, you go with the ecological approach. Well, that doesn't mean more cutting either. That means less cutting. Over and over again, they said that. No one ever responded to our citation of these points. The government did not in its briefs. District Court did not. Never addressed what was in the record. All right, next point. There is no project to challenge in the future. That is a figment of the government's imagination. What actually happens is the agency never proposes a timber sale in critical habitat because they know what's going to happen. There's nothing to challenge. The project, the mythical project, does not exist. That is the reality of the situation. When they meet, when Fish and Wildlife meets with the BLM of the Forest Service, by the way, they meet in secret. There are no notes kept. The public has no idea what they say. And then something happens. So we couldn't challenge it, even if we wanted to challenge it. And there's really no final agency action to challenge. Okay. The standard, the adverse modification standard that is applicable to critical habitat is tied to the recovery of the species, not to jeopardy, not preventing extinction, but actually recovering. It is a very strict standard. And now the agencies cannot adversely modify 3 million acres of the 4 million acres that they were supposed to conduct timber harvest on. So 75% of where the timber was supposed to come from is now subject to the adverse modification standard, which cannot mean more cutting. It can only mean less cutting. Maybe not a complete prohibition, but clearly there's a high likelihood of less cutting, no likelihood of more cutting. All right, finally, back to Mountain State, it did not involve a particular project. It involved a plan for a 400,000-acre section of the national forest in Montana, and it is therefore really, it can't be distinguished as involving a project. So that is just not true. Just you read, especially read the district court decision, actually explains most clearly what it was that they were challenging. All right. That is it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Case is submitted. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Drummond, we'll give you a minute if you'd like it, but don't feel a need to.
Maybe I'll just say very briefly, but I didn't expect
A brief minute is 60 seconds.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. Bear that in mind. Just one point I wanted to make, and this is clear in the briefing, but the counties did establish standing when they intervened, and it was never questioned at any point up until the show cause order. Also, there are a number of cases. I mean, this is the county's standing is consistent with, for example, Funds for Animals v. Norton, where China's natural or the sheep there was a natural resource. Here we have the forest and the owl, which are the county's natural resources. But also pointed the court to Cape Hatteras, County of San Miguel v. McDonald, with very similar analysis. And of course, if the swimmer and Friends of the Earth v. Blade Law has standing, and if the individuals with an appreciation for a battlefield site have standing, then certainly the counties with nearly 20% and up to 50% of their land base designated certainly have standing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Now the case is submitted.